If you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah, left, and then just tumble for a while, then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Welcome, welcome. This is your September 14th edition of the Three Left Show, live in the studio, WCAA at Grand Street here in Albany. My name is Dan Platt. This is the Three Left Show. Let me introduce what it is. This program covers news, issues, thoughts, and activism, and anything of interest from a radical left perspective, for the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. This show is for going in a different direction. Where to start? So, this edition of the Three Left Show. The Three Lefts stand for anarchism, socialism, and ecology, which are kind of the three tendencies that I identify with. You should not, I am a believer in ideology, but I think it's healthy to have more than one, just like eating different food groups. But this is about democracy, this edition. It's about direct democracy. I'm going to be talking about local governance, because to me, anarchism is not no governance. It's no state, no unjustified hierarchies. That's the usual definition. But I think what isn't completely justifiable hierarchy is the kind that are super local, that are with people we know, people we trust. We have to build that trust. That can be very difficult, especially when we are taught or we live in a world where we have so many pressures to make us untrustworthy of each other. For example, I always thought it strange that a good portion of our economy, like the GDP, if we're going to measure it with gross national product, just the amount of value and money being transferred around, that so much of it is based on scams. That, like, how much of the economy would be pulled out? Like, would we go into recession if everyone just stopped scamming each other? Like, if we took out all the businesses that are predicated on lying or tricking or just somehow not delivering value, like an actual social benefit. All the business owners whose business model, their ability to succeed and survive as a business, is predicated on cutting corners, on polluting, on delivering inferior product. Now, theory, liberal theory, says they'll get priced out of the market, or they will, you know, customers will go to someone else. What if they have a monopoly? What if it's a super local, like, monopoly? Just think of all the businesses that survive based on not following rules laid out for social benefit. And, you know, so it's that kind of thought that gets me down the road to anti-capitalism. And we need more anti-capitalists to fight for post-capitalism, which is to say there is a project to work on. There is an alternative. So this edition of the show will be about exploring such alternatives. The kinds that I am for, because I'm honest, I have a bias, it's a bias towards what I don't have a bias towards, the thing, like if there's these political spectrum tests, and if there's a thing where I'm totally waffling and I'm actually centrist on, it's between the question of centralized power and decentralized power. I'm kind of a it depends kind of person. What are we talking about? What problem are we looking to fix? If it's about adapting to climate change, I'm kind of a centralizer. Like, I do think it needs to be the federal government that's centralizing the economy and so on. If it's about local business development or governance decentralized all the way. It's become a hot topic lately. Even Republicans in like the state of Texas, you know, there's a growing number of lawsuits against Google about their monopoly share. Investigating to see if they are a monopoly, because as far as the federal government's concerned, there's no regulating happening. Not for a while. It started during the Obama years. It's not just a Trump problem. It's been a general policy of regulating less. And that in order to get the federal government to regulate any industry, any corporation, you gotta fight them every step of the way. You almost have to do it yourself, which is direct action. But we do that direct action. We do that grassroots organizing with organizations. And I make the case that we should join them to fix them when they're not working, or to build the organizations that we feel would work for us. But many of us don't know how to build a good organization. There are many books on the topic. I have one called Anarchists in the Boardroom. And it's about applying humanism and other such good values to organizational context, whether it be a startup company, a larger context, larger board, corporate area. So it's kind of like how to inject your anarchist values into whatever workplace you're in and make whatever organization you're a part of more humanistic. Because there's the contrast between mechanistic thinking and organic thinking. Because we are live organisms, not machines. And too much of our politic, too much of our thinking about business even, is mechanistic. What's the input? What's the output? Is there a math formula for this? And when there isn't, we go crazy. Example, we need to know for certain that if we do something to fight climate change, we need to know exactly what the outcome will be. But in a natural system, you can't know for sure what the outcome is. You have to take risks. You have to act without knowing what the defined outcome is. Even not only a few years from now, but a century from now. And that's what kind of makes everyone paralyzed. There needs to be like a certainty. So I'm going to start this show off with a piece from Left Voice. They're pretty, for my taste. That means they're authoritarian. Leftist, but at least it demonstrates a problem. So there's a, you know, it's a true complaint about organizations, that whether it is the Green Party or this one is about the DSA. So it's about the DSA convention, the Democratic Socialists of America, that was a month or so ago, and it's written by Tatiana Cozzarelli. This is not what democracy looks like, referring to the convention. So let's go through it, and I'll relate it to my own experiences. I was part of the Occupy movement, and that's where I did a lot of direct democracy, which is different from the more procedural Roberts Rules kind of informed meeting style. And the thing about meetings, okay, no one likes them. No one. But they are sort of necessary. But there is a difference between work meetings, where the main object is to get things done, and the kind of meeting where it is just a brainstorming session about policy, politics, and more conceptual things where you can argue for hours. So let's get into it, and then I'll clarify. The DSA held their biannual, so they do it twice a year, in Atlanta last weekend. It should have been a tour de force. Some important resolutions were voted on, but most of the weekend was spent engaging in procedural bickering. Instead, like the speaker here is like, they're bourgeois. They're elitist. And, you know, this is alienating to workers and normal people, these, you know, overly sensitive, well, actually, yes, overly sensitive activists. Well, guess what? When you're on this autistic spectrum, yes, you are oversensitive. That's kind of part of it and why, debatable, but define it as a disability if you want to. Well, the point of the DSA convention here, the DSA elected officials of various levels, and socialism, or some vague idea of it, has never been so popular. Bernie Sanders is polling at second place in the primary, and DSA member AOC has become one of the most well-known figures in the party. the Democratic Party referring. A new generation is awakening to political activity, and many of them are joining the DSA, mostly because they exist and, for the most part, Bernie Sanders promoted them by using the term Democratic Socialist to describe himself. So people type that in, and the DSA is the first thing that comes up. If he said he was an eco-socialist, the Green Party would come up, and maybe the Green Party would be getting a lot more new members than it did. But it did get some new members. The convention should have a way to organize thousands of socialists to use their strengths to make a concrete plan to fight for immigrant rights against climate change. But this, again, this kind of statement to me is kind of like a wish list, and it's like, okay, well, how does that happen? By magic? But anyway, but it was a crap show, said one New York DSA member. Several different reports of the convention participants. Dan LeBlatz of New Politics, Eric Black in The Nation, and Nathan Robinson, Current Affairs, offered positive reviews. In fact, the only critical report was revealed as a ridiculous hoax. But even DSA enthusiast Black had to admit, more than a few frustrated delegates on Friday evening wondered aloud whether the convention might implode from procedural disputes. By the way, procedural dispute refers to, like, how we're going to vote on this, and just points of order, and just, like, general confusion as to what is happening at any time. The DSA convention offered hours and hours of internal disagreements obfuscated by procedural and organizational discussions. Hours were taken up by appeals to the nearly incomprehensible Roberts Rules of Order. Points of order, points of information, points of personal privilege, over and over and over. Numerous resolutions were left unaddressed, including one calling for a mass strike for reproductive justice, and another preventing police from being part of the DSA. On Twitter, delegates talked about panic attacks, tears, and anger coming from the convention floor. Because when you're really uncertain about what's going on, and there's a lot of power and basically effect that could be happening, yeah, you do get a little panicky and flighty, and I've lived that many times. It grows not from a distaste of having large meetings, but using Robert's rules, because they're from a previous generation, multiple generations ago. And when it comes to decisions like this, like, it can't be a room of hundreds of people. It needs to be delegates that scale down a bit. And there are ways of doing that. Like, I like this one where you have a group of 10 people making a decision, but each of those 10 people has the crowd that they're representing behind them. So if they need to, like, refer back to the crowd, like, they can turn around and ask them, like, and then, like, they're listening. So then they can be discussing things, you know, whispering, and then pass forward, you know, the next thing that needs to be said to the person in front, instead of each individual person raising their hand and getting up and saying their piece. It takes forever, right? So you just scale it down, which is something this meeting didn't do. Because, you know, when you're totally inclusive, when you do the everyone voice needs to be heard, and everyone should be have the ability to speak their piece, that requires, A, cutting people off and enforcing strict time requirements for speaking, or B, more likely, you scale things down via delegates, where even though this convention was a big group of delegates, those delegates need to then delegate. So instead of having a group of hundreds of people voting on something, it's a group of a few dozen. To simplify and to clear and to make, you know, just make it clear how many, you know, how the votes are going to be counted. In a previous article, I wrote about the tyranny of the procedural beforehand, before the convention happened. So this is a kind of a post, you know, post drawing down. This concept, you know, basically they were bashing the DSA and how they do things beforehand, saying that, like, ahead of the convention, it's going to be a mess because they're relying on the procedural, and this obfuscates, basically covers up any political disagreements that actually happen. So it allows one group to dominate. Just think of any local council meeting where it just feels like you're being told to shut up, even though they're just like, oh, sorry, you ran out of time. Gotta follow the rules. This concept was very much on display throughout the weekend's proceedings. Debates on the resolutions were rushed and incomplete. But how could they not be? Resolutions were proposed in a vacuum without a discussion of the broader political context. Now, I'm going to point out that those discussions usually should happen before resolutions are put forward for votes. It's kind of assumed that everyone's already talked about it and knows what their position is. A lot of the chaos happens when no one's really prepared. Facilitators up front say, okay, we're going to vote on this resolution now. And everyone's confused as to what the resolution even is. Or they read the resolution out and then there's basically like 20 questions about like, wait, what does this mean? Where did this come from? You know, there was no actual information movement happening. Even beforehand, and then maybe that's the procedure. You're like, oh, sorry, only people up on this tier got the resolution through this email discussion. Oh, you didn't get the email? And then you have a panic attack. It's like, what the hell's going on? The general organization of the convention unfortunately made it difficult to hold extended political discussion and debate. Such important issues, such as the American political scene, DSA's relationship to the Democratic Party, very important. And there's different like factions in the DSA that argue about that. U.S. foreign policy or the question of oppressed groups in the U.S. The convention was not organized around any political issue, but rather around a series of short summary reports, resolutions, and amendments to their constitution. This way of organizing a convention is a disservice to socialists who put their heart into organizing for socialist feminism, against imperialism, and so on. There were some important resolutions addressing these issues, but even those were discussed so quickly that the convention left the DSA unarmed for the fierce battles that are to come, and without a vision of how those battles are a part of a broader fight for socialism. I don't think the DSA is any more prepared to collectively fight against concentration camps or combat white nationalism after the convention than it was before. The convention did not serve as an opportunity for socialists to sharpen their knives, as an anthem of the Puerto Rican protests put it, against our capitalist enemies. These would be the Puerto Rican protests that got the governor to resign, actually overturn the government in a small way. A note, right now is in fact the New York Green Party's kind of, it's called the State Committee, so it's not really our convention, but it's the State Committee that govern the party. They meet twice a year. They're meeting right now across the river from me. But what I know, because I've attended them in the past, is the spring meeting is usually the one for arguing about the brass tacks and the issues. And then the fall meeting is then the business meeting where the votes are simple and everyone, things just get done in preparation for the next year. Maybe the DSA clarified that, like, oh, the spring meeting was when we argued about stuff. And this was the meeting, this was the convention for voting. But I think if you try to do both at each convention, which is probably what was happening, you both try to debate and clarify and answer questions about things while trying to vote for things. That's when it becomes a mess. So now this writer, let's get their name again, Tatiana, describes the internal politics. Why so much tension and anger? One DSA member told me, if you didn't know the internal politics, the convention was illegible. The convention was defined by fighting between different caucuses, which I described at length in my previous article. This convention demonstrated the strength of the Bread and Roses, which, known for their reformist, pro-Sanders politics, as published in Jacobin and The Call. They are the caucus with the most sophisticated political vision, even if it is reformist, meaning working within the Democratic Party, yeah. Bread and Roses and the Socialist Majority are the two caucuses who are the most enthusiastic about electoral politics inside the Democratic Party, with Bread and Roses committed to a dirty break sometime in the distant future. How distant? And members of the Socialist Majority one are opposed even to this, to breaking from the Democratic Party. Wonderful. I say ironically. Both want a more centralized organization with a stronger focus on national priorities, such as campaigning for Bernie Sanders. Bread and Roses was able to get nearly all of their proposals passed, and the people favoring a more centralized DSA won the majority of their national committee. So it's pretty one-sided, despite that caucus being kind of even with other caucuses that want either a break with the Democratic Party. You know, a lot of chapters like to really focus on local issues. They just want to organize tenants and unions and just do socialist education, because when it comes to organizing and stuff like that, you just gotta educate people first. There needs to be that campaign of education before you can then campaign for the issues and get people activated, which is why I do the show first instead of just door knocking every day or every week, which is an alternative thing I could be doing. But I'm like, because I did that 2 years ago, and I found if I'm going to do this again or more of it, people need to be better informed about, like, alternatives, so that when I come to their door and tell them about, like, hey, I'm with the Green Party and we have the alternatives, they know exactly what I'm talking about, and I don't have to talk to them for half an hour, which is fine. Goes through what was voted on. Ah, yes, I like this part here. The convention voted on several resolutions that were quite left. For instance, delegates voted overwhelmingly to support open borders, with almost 80% in favor of the proposal in preliminary voting. They voted in favor of resolutions for decriminalizing sex work, to create an anti-fascist working group, and in support of anti-imperialism and decolonization, which is a pretty simple position to take, really. What does that entail? But, you know, that's totally left up by working group, right? The DSA also passed a number of resolutions about orienting towards the unionized and the non-unionized, although with a glaring lack of discussion of union bureaucracy. Not a single speaker at the convention questioned the strategy of working within the Democratic Party, which is why I'm not a member of the DSA. However, there were various attempts to rectify and contain the contradictions of this orientation. The Bernie or Bust resolution committed the DSA to refrain from endorsing any Democratic Party candidate other than Sanders, not even Elizabeth Warren, who has taken up much of Bernie's platform, in scare quotes. I'll mention that Warren has announced by being questioned about it, that she would take corporate money for the general election. It just, she's clean of money, corporate money in the primary. Wonderful. They voted to endorse candidates who engage in class struggle elections, quote unquote, whatever that means, and that the National DSA will only endorse open socialists, i.e. only people who call themselves socialists, which seem to include New York City's millionaire, Democratic Socialist Cynthia Nixon, which demonstrates that can be a pretty low bar. Numerous resolutions voted on at this convention were left to the Bernie Sanders, including the one on sex work, foreign policy, and immigration. But some resolutions explicitly called on the DSA to appeal to Sanders to reconsider his positions. As if that hasn't been tried before. Trust me, it has. One of the most contentious resolutions and the one most highlighted the differences between the caucuses was called Pass the Hat. This proposal would have committed $100 to each chapter every month, and it was heavily supported by BILD and the LSC, other smaller caucuses. Whether or not one agrees with BILD's vision of decentralization, that end of the spectrum, the testimonials from comrades in small chapters were shocking. They spoke of paying dues while seeing none of that money, nor any support from the national organization. I'll point out that difference between DSA and Green Party. DSA, you pay dues monthly or yearly, and locals are supposed to get like a quarter to 30% back. With the Green Party, we're just setting up our due paying process, so I guess we're a little behind on that, but we're also an actual electoral party that's national. Certain states, California, I think, is going this direction. New York has had this direction, and we're the envy of other parties, despite I don't feel like we make a lot of headway, but we've kept our ballot line a few cycles now. But we have a due-paying membership, and locals get half the money back, way more than DSA chapters. So DSA chapters are kind of left on their own, and the DSA national level is funded by these dues. And then and the problem with this is then they're deciding carte blanche to basically like, oh yeah, we're going to stay as part of the Democratic Party. We're the left wing of the Democratic Party. And you have all these locals that are like, no, no, we just want to be an actual independent socialist organization that does unionizing, that does base building that I've talked about. At least the Green Party, like we debate about doing all of these things, but particularly like by purpose, our thing is running in elections. That way, DSA and other kind of groups like this, they don't have to rely on the Democrats and being part of that party to run candidates for office. They can rely on us because we are actually politically aligned. So it goes on about Democrats and Bernie. And here, a big tent is teetering. So this is more about like organizations staying smaller. even if like they have a national scope, at least chapters and so on should be smaller, and maybe groups and organizations should just be regional and no bigger. The Big Ten is teetering. The problems demonstrated at the convention are deeply ingrained in the political project of the DSA itself. As a Big Ten organization, it welcomes anyone, except for members of these democratic centralist organizations. To join, you must sign up and pay online. The DSA does not require its members to buy into any agreement to demonstrate any shared baseline understanding of what socialism is, or to agree upon any unified strategy for achieving it. And there is no collective spaces within this organization for any democratic discussion. So how can a group fight together for socialism if they don't have clarity about even what socialism means? This lack of clarity is particularly pernicious, meaning problem, given that there is an ongoing national conversation about the definition of socialism. Like, is it just what the state does? If the state pays for something, is that socialism? Is it worker ownership? Yes. In which the public figures of the DSA are participating. Ocasio-Cortez claims to be one can be both a socialist and a capitalist. Yuck. Bernie Sanders defines socialism as New Deal liberalism. Should the DSA push back against these visions or embrace them? In some ways, thanks to their endorsement of Sanders for president, that decision has already been made. Yet, under the Big Tent, the question, and I want to mention in this person's previous article, I guess I'll include a link to that in the show notes. One of the caucuses is like revolutionary leftists. Yet under the Big Tent, the question of which socialism to work towards, like what is even the goal, is far from settled. While the DSA stubbornly avoided addressing this crucial question directly at its own convention. That's the case because the DSA was founded for a particular purpose back in like the 70s. It was to be an arm of the Democratic Party, or rather, the left wing of the Democratic Party. Because that was in the 70s, more Democrats, Jimmy Carter, progressive as he was, implemented deregulating of corporate power, at least a little bit. I was mentioned in an interview I was listening to. I watched it, actually. It was a video. And I guess I'll link to that, too. I plan on sharing it. That a lot of conservative policy is best left to be implemented by liberal presidents. Organizational questions around centralization or decentralization should derive from political strategy. No socialist organization should see its membership numbers as an end in themselves. Both their R membership and R structures must serve a critical task of pushing for, you know, what our goals are. Under the guise of democracy, bureaucratic mechanisms consolidate their own power in the hands of people who are in the know. Those who know political theory and have previous experience within the socialist left. Those who know Robert's rules and who know how to write and pass resolutions. I could be talking about myself, FYI. I hope not to be like that, but it's... Okay. Paper membership, the influx of new socialists, and confusing internal mechanisms leads to power being centralized in the hands of a bloc who have a clear political strategy. In this case, the Bread and Roses / Jacobin. The magazine, but meaning the editors who are basically the tastemakers. They're crafting the agenda. Let me use this opportunity to plug the Real News Network, their YouTube channel, particularly first, but they're based in Baltimore and they're completely community funded and they are great. You want to be well informed? Watch the Real News Network. Watching Democratic debates on NBC and ABC is not being informed. That is not informing you at all. It's a show. It's a circus. It's for entertainment value. And then, of course, I see a bunch of YouTube videos day later about how bored they were by the debate. Okay. Yeah, so that's all I need to read from this. Now I'm going to focus on the decentralizing aspect. So everything else I'm going to talk about for the next hour and a half, about decentralizing. Actually, less than a half. So let's go quickly. This is from Roar. R-O-A-R, which is a nice little left libertarian magazine. So let's talk about left libertarian policy. Oh, wonderful. Is America ready for a municipalist movement? What does that mean? This is written by Alexander Kolopatronis. In the era of Trump, We will need to consolidate counterpower via participatory democracy and economic self-management at the local level. Now, something I'm hearing is like, we just got to get rid of Trump. Got to get rid of Trump, dude. Nothing else matters. Well, I guess if you only pay attention to politics every 4 years, or you only think the president matters. But when we talk about the age of Trump, we're talking about post-Trump. We're talking about the age we have been living in for quite a while now, actually. Actually, post-08, post-economic crash, where the financial order and economic order that served people, scare quotes, for my lifetime, just stopped really working. And we're kind of left in this malaise as a result, building towards the unrest that we see. So let's go into it. The mass protests across the U.S. in response to Donald Trump's presidential election victory, which, you know, so this kind of dates this article a bit. Yeah, this was back in 2016. 3 years ago now. Whoa, time flies, huh? When you're having fun with Trump. In many cities, anti-Trump demos have included far-left groups, immigration rights activists, Black Lives Matter, reproductive rights supporters, and a number of other political actors. Amidst calls for people power, these different movements together chanted, "Not my president," and vocalized their support for so many other groups that have been marginalized, ridiculed, and discriminated against by the president-elect. People power need not be confined to a chant. The formation of an anti-fascist coalition provides the opportunity to convert these dreams and aspirations into a concrete and transformative program, i.e. project, something to work on, at the municipal level. What role can anti-fascism play in building this alternative? So the kind of historical conceit as our country goes into decline, let's accept that, or that we're going to be in crisis and that we have a continuing crisis, that things are going to get more localized. Communication channels and the global supply chain will break down as climate change intensifies. Many companies talk about adapting and being resilient to climate change, but I'm skeptical of how they can deliver that. So here's a municipal counter voice. And it's also part of, you know, the election of Trump is maybe a splash of cold water that we can't rely on the federal government for anything. That people power does in fact come from below. First, Trump's program included canceling all federal funding to sanctuary cities. Quoting them, these serve as safe havens for undocumented immigrants. The protection can also include proactive policies, such as providing some form of documentation through ID programs, which has been to New York City and now particularly across the state. Trump's stated opposition to sanctuary cities has put such municipalities at the forefront of the, quote, resistance. Mayors in Seattle, San Fran, New York City, L.A., and Philly have all pledged that their cities will remain sanctuaries, even under threat from Donald Trump. If Trump is to move forward with his plan to deny funding to these cities, such places will be forced to think creatively about how they can, together, as a confederation of municipalities, resist. Fractures between national and local governments will be widened. There's already kind of national council slash convention of mayors. Second, policy innovation has already taken place at the municipal level. Practice of sanctuary cities is just one example. City governments in San Fran, Bay Area, New York City, Greater Boston, Chicago are increasingly funneling resources into worker co-op development and in devolving fiscal capacity to the community through participatory budgeting, both of which have also empowered undocumented immigrants, to say the least. Where these developments are limited, even within the context of cities themselves, but they can be pushed much further. The way for this to be done is through anti-fascist coalitions. In many of these cities, there exists a smattering of progressive and even left-wing forces. This election, as including the next one, the one next year, has provided a sustained impetus for such groups to come together beyond the level of protest and contesting, but we have been seeing in recent weeks. Third, current crisis in the Democratic Party may not threaten its existence for the time being, but its failure to nominate a presidential candidate who is not a neoliberal technocrat has strengthened the call for a party that advances for more robust alternative. So this is represented by the DSA that I just spent the last half an hour talking about. Under a Trump presidency, those who are committed to resisting fascism and advancing alternative will have an opportunity to advance the latter in municipal contexts. Fourth, Bernie Sanders' campaign has allowed for the normalization of the word socialism at the municipal level too. The somewhat vague footing of the term democratic socialist leaves the door open to other interpretations that are not simply social democratic, referring to New Deal programs. Yeah, other interpretations that can veer off into a libertarian socialism that seeks to create post-state, post-capitalist institutions. With the terminology of democratic socialism only recently being mainstreamed, there is ample opportunity to not simply ask what socialism means, but what it can mean at a policy level. As such, this is not simply about individual municipalities acting on their own, but about formal, non-state, federalist arrangements between municipalities, such as the ones named above, not just like metropolitan areas. So now to describe libertarian municipalism. There's a mouthful. A new ism, oh no! But this is actually kind of the ism that just is a name to everything that I usually talk about anyway. I'm just getting around to... coming from Murray Bookchin, an American eco-anarchist who became a self-styled communalist, that's the other word for this, proposed the idea of a libertarian municipalism, a notion that has relied on the development of a confederal political structure as a counterpower to centralized nation-states, meaning the feds. In the next revolution, Bookchin broadly outlines a program and rough design of libertarian municipalism and this kind of confederalism of cities and towns. Within cities, he discusses the possibilities of advancing a minimum policy program and a maximum one. The former meets demands for improved welfare and generates pockets of direct participation that serve as stepping stones to a more wholesale transformation. The maximum program is one in which people power is at the center of this transformation. Hence, decision-making power is transferred from these representative institutions to to more direct assemblies. For Bookchin, one approach to achieving both the minimum and the maximum is to electorally engage in a potentially important center of power, the local council, so as to compel it, meaning like a city council, town board, to compel it to create legislatively potent neighborhood assemblies. More specifically, Bookchin writes that communalists do not hesitate to run candidates for local elections who, if elected, would use that real power their offices confer to legislate these assemblies into existence. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why I am part of the Green Party and why I run for local office, is really just to do that. Everything else is window dressing, really. It's my main argument, actually. This is explaining why I do that. Because otherwise, I'm kind of a pariah in some circles. Not that I'm unlikable, but that, like, oh, Dan, the Green Party guy. Doesn't he know electoralism is a dead horse? Taking a step further, Bookchin writes that this alternative would be based on a network of policy-making assemblies with recallable deputies that are both local and regional. So it's the vision, it's the big goal that, you know, it's like, this is what we could have instead of all of these petty representative bodies where you have a bunch of glad-handing, rural, bureaucratic, technocrat, I got it covered, you can just go back to watching TV governance. Janet Beale, Bookchin's longtime partner, intellectual one, writes that city charters and other constitutions would be altered to legitimate the power of these assemblies. Many on the left, including anarchists, are paying closer attention to the role of constitutions. One may even take this further to look at the possibilities of advancing a post-state monetary system that is consistent with this, such as that outlined by a Nathan Cedric Tangus. Whatever the complications might be in terms of the relationship between these policy-making and administration, representation and direct participation, and other issues, Bookchin's broader point is that municipalities can be the site of this kind of transformation, institutional kind, and the material basis for the construction of viable counterpower to corporate power, to state power. Because otherwise, what are we left with doing? It describes anti-fascist fronts and coalitions, counterpower at the local level. Yeah, let's read the last part. Other municipalities are forming a more libertarian following this line. While Poor Allegro is often mentioned for its success in designing and implementing participatory budgeting, more on that later, a number of municipalities have taken the principles of participatory budgeting one step further. For example, in Venezuela, 100% of the investment budget for the town of Torres is decided upon through participatory budgeting. This means that the assembly of people is in fact voting on how to allocate money instead of scientific bureaucrats, which is very, very biased. Many cities in Spain have become sites of innovation for cooperative economics, as well as this kind of democracy. Even in the U.S., a victorious mayoral campaign advanced by a platform similar to libertarian municipalism called the Jackson Plan, promoted by what is called the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, and the former mayor of Jackson, the late Chukwuga Lumbuya, has three pillars: building people's assemblies, building a broad-based solidarity economy, sometimes put as building a Mondragon of the South, Mondragon being like a big co-op corporation in Spain, and building a network of progressive political candidates. Now, they've actually dropped their electoral side of strategy because, as I did read this out last spring, actually, in my Our Elections Worth It episode, that they were spending so many of their resources, like keeping their... They not only won seats on their local council, but they, A, found themselves being blocked by the state government. They would literally legislate to basically stop them from doing socialist things, progressive things. They also found that they were spending so much of their resources keeping their people in office, they were neglecting the other pillars. Right now, the nascent anti-fascist movement is coalescing in cities and towns across the U.S., yet this movement need not remain in the state of pure opposition and resistance. Indeed, these coalitions can and must be formed that leverage power to advance this program, or a program that, in fact, does something different. So that's basically the end of that. Okay, I've reached the end of the first hour. Stay tuned. I'm going to go deeper into the things that I used a lot of buzzwords and things that I needed to explain. Stay tuned. This has been the Three Left Show.
They got cops on the streets, walking in lines with taser guns, wooden batons, trying to keep you scared for violent attacks. You know, it all comes down to how you react, and now you're face to face, seeing it all, dispersal warnings and making the call. They got buses to pack with people like you, and they did that in the 50s. The movement grew. Young student, new to the game, movement elder, fan of the flames, combat veteran, seen it before, seen tactics used in the foreign war. Final warning, you're keeping your ground. Committed people sitting all around. Through the bullhorn, it's all distorted. You can't leave now. We can't afford it. Hold the line. Even if your voice shakes, friend of mine. Even if your voice shakes, push forward. It's up to you. See it through. As I was saying earlier, what happens here in New York right now is a big deal around the world. Y'all have a lot of leadership right now in your hands. You got a lot of power. And you gotta use it. You gotta move. Know that you're inspiring people. Know that you're moving people. And people are looking to you. Just add a little weight on your shoulders. And the silence breaks. Voices are loud. Rubber bullets crack. Pierce the crowd. Heart starts pumping. Scared but proud. Because the people still sitting in the tear gas cloud. The line advances. They're swinging sticks to the marching boots. And the taser clicks. Screaming erupts. Someone got struck. People calling for a medic. They better hurry up. Now the bombing comes like a flood. Getting choked by the gas. Hands covered in blood. Bruised and beaten. Limping away. Remember, it's always been this way. They'll beat you down. Show you the guns. And the violence sometimes. And then change comes. You stand firm, organize. And then cut back. And there's too many people. For them to attack, you gotta hold the line. Even if your voice shakes, friend of mine. Even if your voice shakes, push forward, it's up to you. See it through. And again, this isn't just about the violence. It's not just about the pseudo-romanticism of being in the streets when the police are attacking you. Like, you know, tear gas looks really cool in photographs and it sucks in real life. But in retrospect, it always feels really magical. But this isn't just trying to glorify the militant shit. It's about that day-to-day shit. If you're a teacher, if you're a parent, you know what I mean? If you're recovering from an addiction, all these things. But also if you're politically organizing and you're at square A or B and you're trying to get to F or further and you're looking ahead thinking, fuck. But you gotta start and you gotta stick with it when you know that you're right, you know, when you're doing the right thing. So. And it's days like this when something clicks, when you're confused, tired, and scared as shit. But your body's alive, and that heartfelt drive you against the prop right before your eyes. But you could have ran, but you stayed and sat when you were beaten and gassed, and you still came back. I'm feeling a power that you got deep down rises to the top when you get beat down. There's a world to win when your heart is strong, and nothing new wrongs to focus on. Every day brings a vision to strive for, something to live and die for. When you go back home and you're on your own, it's easy to feel like you're all alone. But it's your memory and hope that will stay supported, cause we can't quit now, we can't afford it. Hold the line, even if your voice shakes, friend of mine. Even if your voice shakes, push forward, it's up to you.
I'm your host, Dan Platt. Welcome back to this program covers news, issues, thoughts, and activism, anything of interest from a radical left perspective. This edition, I am talking about direct democracy. What does it look like? So here is a piece. That's a great question, and that is exactly the title of this piece from the New Compass. Yes, there was an old compass back in the day, old days, leftist rag called the Compass, and that was the New Compass with this piece by Camilla Hansen. What would real democracy look like? So this is just expounding upon what I've already talked about, just going deeper. That is kind of how I do things on this program. Today, democracy is equated with representative government based on free elections, so-called, of political elites that rule on the citizens' behalf. The system referred to as representative democracy has been a dominant one in the West for the last 200 years. It is now being exported across the world and promoted as the only possible alternative to dictatorship. But this system is now in a deep crisis. In established the democracy's representative trust in political elites, yes, they are political elites, and conventional institutions is crumbling. Participation and thus the turning demagogues. Participation in elections is shrinking. Political parties are losing their members. In the old, well-developed democracies of Europe, the streets are boiling as millions protest against unpopular and brutal austerity policies imposed on them from above. More and more people are now realizing that their elected reps do not represent them. Instead, they serve money. Rather, governments of both left and right bow to the dictates of big banks, financials, multinational corporations, and their powerful lobbies. In this situation, the ballot has little meaning because we have no real choice. We can only change political elites that rule us, but we do not have the right to decide upon the development of the society we live in. A real democracy, however, is a direct and participatory one, in which all citizens have the possibility and the right to take part in decisions that affect their lives, proportionally speaking. While the powers that be and mainstream media and pundits argue that such a citizen-based democracy is not possible or even desirable, there exists, in fact, a range of new institutions and experiments, as well as some old ones, that show that a direct and participatory democracy is both possible and feasible today. These innovations, however scattered and limited, could, if improved, strengthened, and spread out, be tools for radical democratization of society. In this article, I will take a look at some of these things. So the first is participatory budgeting, mentioned in the previous article. The popular assembly, where citizens meet face-to-face to discuss, vote, and make collective decisions, is the original form of democracy. You know, the town hall meeting. Historically, these different kinds of popular assemblies have existed in many communities across the world. Village assemblies in North Africa, assembly in ancient Athens, the Landgemeinden of the medieval Swiss cantons, and the town meetings of the 17th century New England, which still occur to the last century. The recent decades of a myriad of new democratic institutions have been created across the world, in which popular assemblies form the essential part of that structure. The most famous being PB, participatory budgeting, which I'm going to call PB from now on. PB lets residents decide how to spend their city or municipality's public budget through a process in an assembly in each neighborhood. It was first developed in the city of Porto Alegre in southern Brazil in the late 80s, when the Brazilian Labor Party, PT, won their elections after the end of the military dictatorship. Since then, it has spread to hundreds of cities across Latin America, Europe, and the U.S. In the neighborhood assemblies, all residents have the right to participate and to vote on budget priorities of their neighborhood. These assemblies elect delegates to a regional or budget council. You know, they create committees out of people who show up, and those committees then craft the project proposals, and then a vote's held on election day. Imagine voting for projects instead of people who then promise projects. Large numbers participate in this process, in some places 100,000 each year. Usually the majority of the participants are women, the poor, and other sections of the population that are marginalized by the conventional political system. Participatory budgeting, PB, has led to many positive results, including poverty reduction, a redistribution of the budget to the poorest neighborhoods, and a large reduction in corruption, and the more transparency as well as a more vibrant civil society. You know, the kind of thing everyone complains about lacking. However, there are large variations in this design of the of different models of PB, which have spread across the world, kind of based on whatever government you kind of have already locally. The strong models give the residents decision-making power over an entire or large part of the budget and are based on neighborhood assemblies where all residents can take part and vote on these. It is these strong models that produce the best results with that decline in corruption and so on. In the original model of PB that was created in Porto Alegre, several rules were built into the process that encouraged participation and ensured accountability. The more residents that took part, the more delegates that neighborhood got in the regional forums that could then argue for their neighborhood's priorities. This mechanism mobilized many, especially from the poor and marginalized neighborhoods, to participate. Now contrast that to our local elections, where it doesn't matter how many people take part, the winner of a winner-take-all election is the winner. Doesn't matter how many people vote, the results are canceled out, like say if only 20% show up. You know, we should have a rule that 50% of voters have to show up if your election is going to count. If it doesn't, then you have to hold another election. Or no one's elected at all. And then, who decides when the pothole gets filled? That's how American democracy works. But imagine that difference. A major dilemma of PB is the question of legislative power. In Venezuela and Peru, PB is mandatory for all of the country's municipalities by national law. Most cases of PB around the world, though, have no direct legislative power. In Porto Alegre, participatory budgeting is not codified into the law. The reason for this was to keep it flexible. It made it possible to gradually expand the process to give people more power. But on the other hand, by not being codified, it also means that the local government, the electeds, can abolish or restructure it at any time. Thus, the process gets vulnerable and can be undermined. PB, as it was first conceived in Porto Alegre, is also facing other challenges. As Carol Patterman documents in her essay, A Participatory Democracy Revisited, many of these institutional models that are being promoted as PB bear very little resemblance to the original model. These are models where citizens either have decision-making power over a tiny fraction of a budget or some small additional funds, which is the case in a town or city in California that does it. They instituted like a small sales tax, and then that revenue was the PB budget. So it would be for new projects. This is probably what a lot of us American cities would need to do to get this going, because it was brought up in a kind of committee in my city, and it was just decided we don't have the money, so we're not going to do it. Like, okay, no democracy for us, I guess. We got a budget hole. Or it's called participatory, but really it's just citizens who get to consult or give feedback to the government, which is kind of what we have in my city, which is, it leaves a lot to be desired for sure. It's better than just bureaucrats making decisions without you, so it feels a little better, but it's also still up to them at the end of the day. If PB is to be a tool for general democratization of society, citizens must be given the power along with this. And the process must be bottom up. Local authorities must be willing to give away power to the residents in the assemblies. And there is a need for a democratization of power from the national and international levels. This later happened in Brazil as the country's constitution in 1988 moved considerable power to municipalities, including economic power. So the next piece is communal councils themselves. And what is a communal council? So we're going back to Venezuela. And this is something our national media will never talk about. It'll just say that they're starving because we have put them under embargo. the U.S. government has. And it would be nice if we didn't do that. But it's like, well, we don't like the government and we want them to resign, so we're just going to starve the people. We're just going to put the whole country under siege. Isn't that fair? And then when people starve, we're going to say it's the government's fault because they're not backing down. Why should they? But here's one of the positives from that government, that left-leaning socialist government. Another participatory institution based on popular assemblies is the Conscientos Comunales, Trino Council in Venezuela. Trino councils are small local participatory institutions composed of about 200 to 400 families, meaning a neighborhood, or 20 to 50 in a rural area. They make decisions about the initiation and the implementation of local projects. Projects which include basic services like water and sewage, electricity, medical clinics, housing, road building, as well as cultural activities. So the funding of festivals and parties and parades. All decisions are made through these assemblies composed of at least 10% of residents over 15 years. The assemblies also elect committees, so they delegate others to do the financial management, the monitoring of the government above them, and to address local priorities and study priorities like health, education, you know, the things that local governments do. In a few years, the communal council has become very popular, and there are now over 30,000 of them across Venezuela. And because of their investment and their choosing of projects, many of them are in fact getting more independent of the federal government itself. So this whole, like, socialism just means centralization. Here is an example of decentralizing power. As a PB in Brazil, decentralization was a crucial step in moving power downwards to ordinary citizens. Although the Communal Council's law was passed in 06, a decentralization process started way back in the 80s, which paved the way. Though this process, considerable power was moved from national to regional to then local levels. In 06, this process was continued and deepened by the Chavez government by moving power further down from local governments to then the citizens in each neighborhood. However, these councils still have to apply to the Presidential Commission for funding. This gives the central government in Caracas the final power to decide which projects will be funded. National agencies also determine the rules which guide the communal councils. Now, I covered earlier in the spring that there was a convention of these councils, and they were basically demanding that the reins be kind of loosened on this. In fact, that they should just be given the money, no veto power from the president. None of these weaknesses are unfixable. The communal councils have potential to be strengthened and further democratized. Council participants and local movements are actively struggling to take power back from the central government, which is what I just said. PB and communal councils are two of the most well-known cases of participatory institutions, and they take a role. I thought it mentioned how much money they were given, but basically billions of dollars have been divvied out this way. Next is sortition and mini-publics. So this is something that even I kind of am learning about here. It's a more kooky kind of thing to do, which is pretty fun, actually. It sounds fun on the face of it to me. Certain democratic mechanisms are essential to these institutions. But as they present the establishment of a cemented and professionalized political class, which is insulated from ordinary citizens, right? Outlining an alternative to political elites. Such mechanisms include short and limited terms of elected delegates. Delegates being recallable at any time. The rotation of delegates is another way to prevent the creation of such elites to ensure diversity. So there's always this kind of professionalization impetus that someone's more active in, say, this participatory system, and then they just become an expert in it, and then they can start gaming it. And these are the objections that are brought up. Like, oh, we can't have real democracy. It'll be gamed by somebody. What, you mean like now? Where you have someone in office for a lifetime, that they're not gaming the systems, they're accountable to the people. There's nothing more annoying than someone who says, like, oh, we don't need term limits. A well-informed electorate is a term limit. Tell that to the people who've been in office for, like, 20 years. Were their terms limited by an informed electorate? Do you think we have a informed electorate now? There's so many assumptions with that that are just, like, faulty premise, dude. faulty logic. Okay. So how do you get around that? Well, you actually have term limits, for one thing. Or you cycle through representatives, and you even make it kind of like jury duty, which is what sortition is. So another mechanism that effectively prevents establishment of elites is sortition, or selection by lot. The use of lot played an important role in the democracy of ancient Athens, where most positions of political authority were selected this way. For Aristotle, the philosopher, selection by lot was central to democracy, while elections were the mark of an oligarchy. In the Athenian democracy, which is the case because America has pretty much always been an oligarchy, ruled by the few. In the Athenian democracy, lot ensured that citizens could rule and be ruled in turn, and together with rotations, it functions as a defense against oligarchy. In modern representative systems, however, selection by lot is absent. Democracy, in scare quotes, is now exclusively equated with competitive elections for positions. However, the last decades has been a range of experience with sortition in deliberative institutions like these assemblies, citizen juries, consensus conferences, planning cells, as they're called, and deliberative polls, often referred to as mini-publics. Sortition was also recently used in the first part of the process of to write a new constitution in Iceland. In mini-publics, deliberation is usually guided by an independent facilitator. The participants hold hearings in which they hear evidence from the questioned expert witnesses, and deliberations usually take place both in plenary and in small groups, plenary being like a large group. Participants are selected for mini-publics, though the use of statistical sampling to ensure that citizens from all social groups are representative. For example, population's half women. Half of the people picked should be women. 20% of students. 20% should be students. And then half of those students. 1% are non-binary. At least 1 out of 100 reps or people chosen should be non-binary, so that some voice for the non-binary exists. Experiments with mini-publics and recent use of sortition, however, have given us rich proofs that ordinary citizens are able to discuss and solve complex problems when given the possibility to do so, and that they are able to take important decisions in the public interest. In the right context, anything is possible. Several democratic theorists have recently made proposals for different kinds of political bodies, including legislative ones. So to the cynics out there, I'm going to repeat again, in the right context, anything is possible. In the right context, you can make a moral man into a murderer, and you can make the conniving, money-grubbing, only cares about self narcissist actually make decisions for the public good in a ethical manner in the right context. But there has to be that right context, and that right context is not in the voting booth. It's not at a city council meeting. It's in assemblies. It's in these group meetings where you're surrounded by people just like you. And then you kind of have to confront whatever latent narcissism you have or whatever toxic attitudes. And even if you personally, or like say the person opposite of you that you see as toxic, you get to confront them about it. Because in a context of procedure and following the rules, it's hard to do that. But good facilitation, I've seen it occur, where you can, in fact, confront toxic behavior and bring it to, a resolution. Just saying. So this is something that Michael Moore is actually promoting quite a bit, which is the Citizen Initiative. Now, in New York, we don't have this, and that's a big problem. Citizen initiatives are a mechanism to let citizens propose and vote on laws and policies. By gathering a certain amount of signatures, citizens can demand a binding vote. Let's see, these initiatives differ from referendums, they differ, in which citizens can only accept or reject a law. Switzerland was the first country to do citizen initiatives as well as referendums, and several countries, mostly in Europe and Latin America, have since introduced them at national, state, and local levels. The promise of citizen initiatives is the way in which they can give citizen power to initiate and directly decide upon large-scale issues. But like the other democratic institutions and mechanisms discussed above, citizen initiatives also have their limitations. A common problem is that the large numbers of signatures required for a short-term time frame ensure that only those who can afford to use expensive professional signature gathering firms can submit an initiative. Now, I'll mention having a party and having organizations that are dedicated, like grassroots ones, dedicated to petition gathering is essential. To run for office requires signature gathering. I've done it. I have experience there. Something I'll mention that I don't think is mentioned here is, actually, it was mentioned kind of briefly with that whole, like, it was with the, you know, the council listens to expert testimony and then they deliberate. That's the kind of balance between expertise and mass participation. So usually, so another gripe about democracy is most people are not fully informed about what they're deciding on, right? When it comes to making choices about water, you want maybe a hydrologist making those decisions, right? But the decision of the hydrologist then affects all of the people drinking the water, and they should have a proportional say in how water is delivered to them. So the balance is to have a mass democratic process for choosing how you get your water, informed by the hydrologist, right? So this occurs in having public meetings, which we have plenty of in my locality and is probably growing, where you have a public meeting with the expert to answer questions. Now, the problem with right now in my city is that then the next step, which does not happen, is then that body then gets to actually decide on something, or now their informed opinion actually counts for something, instead of just acting as a placation of sorts. So there's the balance, to have a place for expertise, but that expertise is their job to set out the proposal, right? The options, to determine the options, the best options, the reasonable options. Then it is up to the masses, the citizenry, to then determine which of those options is best for them. So there's still some power in the expertise to determine the options. But those options are then, they're guided by the masses, and then the masses have final say in what happens. That's the democratic process that I and these articles envision. And don't see things as this binary between mob rule, chaos, and oligarchic, technocrat, authoritarian, top-down, rule by experts, rule by elite, you know, people who are qualified, the most qualified. Because usually the people who are most qualified are also the most isolated from the rest of society. And then it mentions the need for a grassroots network to fight for basically all of these things. It mentions Occupy Oakland activists that emphasize these things. This is exactly what happened in Torres and Venezuela. Hundreds of citizens occupied City Hall to demand the implementation of PB. The result of their popular struggle was one of the world's best PB systems, in which the residents had control over all of the local investment budget. For a radical democratic change to happen, there must be a large popular movement demanding and struggling for this change. And unless ideas, and that means confrontation, but unless ideas of direct and participatory democracy are known and familiar to most people, such movements will not emerge. For a first step, then, is to spread these ideas and make a strong argument for how direct democracy can be feasible today. That's exactly why I'm doing this. I have a piece from Current Affairs called Every State Should Be a Microstate. And microstate refers to actually like a city state, like a state that is a town. It is the state itself. And just like how we are the United States of America, we have 50 plus extra states with full open borders between us, that if we want power, right, to basically break down, and this may happen anyway, naturally, over the next few hundred years, the federal government breaks down, we lose contact with them, or they still exist, but they're really just, it's just all pageants and we're kind of left on our own devices. We break up into microstates. We break up into regional states. And that just gets rid of this endless debate about like federal power versus state power. Just make every locality a state. States that have open borders between them. mosaic, if you will. A mosaic is made up of many thousands of pieces, each piece a different color. Now, there are problems with, say, ethno-nationalists, you know, racists forming their own state, and they make the case for this. So there's kind of a left and a right both kind of take this libertarian stance of these microstates. But the point is, for these, just as we're the United States, you can still have a overarching institution that for protecting human rights to appeal to. I want to read all of this, but it's a very long piece. It's got a lot of stuff because he goes into history of microstates, city-states, and their advantages economically as well as politically. And just kind of the ways in preventing colonial cycles from repeating themselves, why we'd all like living in one. So what I will do instead is, I think it was not actually... Well, it was mentioned in the microstate one, which is why I did have these in a particular order. But I'm going to skip then to this piece about one of those microstate democratic confederalist projects that are part of this kind of new vision. And I've mentioned them in the past episodes briefly. The Zapatistas, in southern Mexico. But they have announced big news, okay? The news is not that this place exists, this, the small society. That is, social anarchist. But they actually have made an announcement. Da 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 da! Zapatistas announced a major expansion of their autonomous territories. This is in August. In a surprise announcement, this is their acronym, EZLN, which is like Zapatista Liberation Army, proclaimed the creation of 11 new caracoles. With meaning autonomous municipalities, significantly expanding the territory under these rebels' control. So usually when it comes to being a rebel, being free from overbearing government control, it means going to the hills, living the life of anarchists, living as guerrillas. And the Zapatistas are a very large group of rural indigenous people that basically seceded from the Mexican government, free from cartels, free from corruption. They did this in the 90s. And they did this by taking direct action and winning leverage against the federal government by way of seizing a number of towns militarily, like they invaded from the countryside. And they pulled back very quickly. Not a lot of life was lost. They mostly just shot cops. When the military rolled in, they pulled back and prepared and dug in for a guerrilla war. But there was so much support for them, because there was so much corruption in the government at the time, as there still is, that the sort of left-wing government at the time made a deal with them. They get to have their little slice of a country and their autonomous zones for peace. So, yeah. Direct action comes in many forms. And I have a book on their experiences, first-hand accounts and all that. And it's called First World... Ha ha ha. Because it was at the exact time that you had the president saying, like, from, you know, signing NAFTA, from now on, we're a first world country now, no longer second world. But this meant basically the destruction of rural economies, the kind of destruction and upheaval which drove the millions of immigrants into our country, that we've seen since the 90s. So, Mexico becoming first world meant desperation for millions. But not the Zapatistas. They fought back and won their independence. Now they've announced they're growing. It all started in typical Zapatista fashion with the publication of 4 new communiques signed by Subcommandant Insurgent Galano, which is formerly known as Marcos. Subcommandant Marcos was like their spokesperson, mascot almost. Between August 10th and the first one titled Opening Act ended on mysterious note. Look, ladies and gentlemen and others, nothing to see here, nothing to see there. But wait, all of a sudden, boom, the Zapatista communities reappear. Those familiar with the Subcommandant's literary style already knew that something big was about to follow. The communiques analyzed the political reality in Mexico and the challenges faced by indigenous peoples under the AMLO's presidency, which is the new pseudo-left-wing president of Mexico. And his so-called fourth transformation, which presumes that his term in office will leave a historical footprint similar to that of the Mexican Revolution and the country's independence from Spain. Thus far, Alamo's rule has been characterized by a typical capitalist drive for the exploitation of the environment and the extraction of natural resources, not that dissimilar from his more conservative predecessors. Despite the progressive rhetoric, his mega projects, among which the Amaya train, the Trans-Isthmus Corridor, and the Project Sembrando Vida, meaning planting life, are particularly illustrative of the new administration's disregard for the environment and its indigenous protectors. I refer back to my more ecological episodes where I talk about the environmental destruction and hellscapes created in Mexico by companies like Walmart that have industrial centers there and they built them, as well as the hog plants, the place where we basically get all our pork, you know, things where swine flu and other diseases have developed because it's just unaccountable hellscapes. The top-down nature of these projects, along with the threats they pose to the well-being of both social and natural environments across the country in general, and to the Zapatista communities in particular, have led to them to condemn them in the strongest terms. They also highlight the fact that during this presidency, Alamo, a number of indigenous defenders of Mother Earth and members of the National Indigenous Congress, in which the Zapatistas also participate, have been assassinated under highly suspicious circumstances. The most well-known case is that of Asimo Flores Sombreres, an indigenous journalist and activist who was assassinated for campaigning against the Proyecto Indegro Morales, a controversial plan to build a thermoelectric plant and gas pipeline in Morelos, his home state. But the real news was announced in a communique signed by Subcomandant Moiseos, published in August 17th, that the Zapatistas have created 7 new municipalities. In doing so, that they have significantly expanded their organizational capacity and their autonomy. Honoring Samir and the many other targeted rights, social environmental rights defenders, Zapatistas have named their initiative after a person who was assassinated, Samir. Ironically, while Alamo aspired for his presidency to form a critical juncture for the country, it is now some of his loudest critics on the left who appear to be stealing the show. Creation of 7 new Cacoles and 4 new Martes marks the most historically significant moment for the Zapatistas since 03, when they formed the 5 currently existing ones. So going from 5 to 12. The expansion also signifies an impressive growth in the organizational capacity of this movement, which has now led to the creation of new Zapatista centers. It is the movement's social and territorial expansion that has led to the need for more of these municipalities, this partitioning of districts. So imagine for a moment in your state, big group of leftists or indigenous peoples from the reservation, they declare their independence. They fight a small, very limited war against the government. They win some autonomy and rights. Now they have their own zone, and they have announced that they have expanded it, that they are now, instead of 5 towns, they are now 12. Now this piece also describes their electoral tactics as well as their autonomous strategies. This historical development did not occur in a vacuum. It is, in fact, the result of an internal reorganization of this movement that was quietly pursued over the past few years. Moreover, for the past few months, Zapatista communities have been closed to outsiders, and even the few communities that were open to human rights observers in the past have been closed for some time now. So it could have been a signal that they were doing something nefarious. Ooh. Only La Realidad, where Maestro Galeano was assassinated some years ago, remained open throughout this period. This internal closure may have had something to do with the organizational expansion, which has now been announced. The Zapatistas did not want their plans revealed until they were ready to reveal them to the world themselves. Until now, in their own words. Now that's some editorial power. In addition, the expansion of their Zapatista autonomy, comes as an answer to the critics among the Mexican and international left, in particular among other anarchist movements, that accused the Zapatistas for taking an electoral turn when in 2016 they backed Maria de Jesus Pacheco Martinez, an indigenous woman, as a joint candidate together with the CNI, that's that Indigenous Congress, for the 2018 presidential elections. At the time, Many viewed it as a strategic turn of the movement, while others viewed it as a tactic. The latter interpretation seems to be closer to the truth, since the Zapatistas clearly had not abandoned the construction of their autonomous self-governance. On the contrary, they are now expanding it. So, to me, this is practical proof that one can be electoral and endorse candidates or take part in elections, especially when they're independent, alternative, radical candidates, and still be a good anarchist. Go figure. At least, especially when you think of electoral politics as a tactic, part of a toolkit, not an end in themselves. You know, you win office, and then you fight for the policy, and boom, you're done. No way. So now something about these new communities. With the announcement regarding the creation of 11 new Carres, which is a collective name for both Caracoles and the autonomous municipalities, the number of these is now 43. 12. So I guess you can think of them as counties and then towns within those counties. 12 counties, 31 towns. Or maybe more accurate would be 12 towns and 31 neighborhoods. Most likely, yeah, the one is a subdivision of a town. Because this is a rural area we're talking about. So it's mentioning, it's describing some of these new ones. Half of these paragraphs are in Spanish. And I think that it's basically describing the names that they have. And they're all basically very stylized revolutionary names. One is of a main revolutionary from the 18th century. Another is named, they basically have stylized names like Thinking People and so on. New Freedom, blah, blah, blah. One's called Hope for Humanity. Another is named after Che Guevara. One is called the 21st of December. The Zapatistas also invite the adherents of the Sixth Declaration and others to participate in the construction of these by sending money, material, and even their own labor. Details of how this can be done will follow in the upcoming communiques. Now let's close out. A new Zapatista era. A lot of will be written and even more will be revealed later on regarding this new initiative. What is sure at this stage is the birth, that of the 11 new Zapatista centers, marks first a critical juncture in the history of Zapatismo, which is just the name of the movement. The most important after the birth of the first five towns in 2003. Second, it signals the end of a long period of internal reorganization on behalf of it, which was decided to open itself up to the world again, breaking the siege under which they had found themselves, as Morales described the situation in his last statement. In addition, the Zapatistas, with Subcommandant Sergio Galeno, new communiques take position on the front lines of a struggle against climate change, which is a struggle against capitalism. This is written by Leonidas Okionomakatis. He is of CoFund, a junior research fellow at Durham in the anthropology department. He's also a rapper with Greek hip-hop collective Social Waste and a member of the Roar Magazine's editorial team. He's also written a book, Political Strategies and Social Movements in Latin America, the Zapatistas and Bolivarian Colocados. If I've got that word pronunciation right, I probably don't. So, first, my profound thanks for listening. Listening is an important skill, and often as important as talking. So I plan to listen to any constructive feedback you send me. Ideas for the show, other stories and topics you'd like to hear to be discussed. Capitalism doesn't believe work like mine is worth paying a living wage, giving good advertising. So you could support the show materially by liking it, sharing it, via word of mouth, social media, which means Facebook and Twitter, as well as giving on the Patreon page. And the most important thing, putting the ideas and projects talked about here in practice yourself. Thanks, and stay radical. Bye.